This arrangement has not satisfied the Tibetans, who want and feel entitled to payment in dollars. Unless India pays Tibetan traders in dollars, we must find a way to trade directly with the dollar world, he said, through Dawes interpretation. Even the remote Tibetans know about the present value of the American greenback. From Shekhappa's home on the eastern edge of town, Dawes led us back to the Foreign Office, where we met the members of that august body, the Kashag cabinet. All the clerks in the office bowed low as their superiors from the Kashag entered. Only three of the powerful Shapatilda copyright S were present, the fourth had gone to the Chinese frontier at Chamdo to check on their communist threat. This important trio was headed by the Kalon Lama Rampasa Wang Lama, the senior minister. The Kalon Lama wore no hat to hide his bald head. The two lay Shapatilda copyright S, Sakang Sawang Kempo, son of Tibet's foreign minister, and Ragasha Sawang, followed. Their yellow silk robes were tied with red sashes. They took off their broad-brimmed gold brocade hats, which had red crowns surmounted with tarnished turquoise spikes, and revealed their official headdresses. Their black hair was tied with red ribbon in a double top knot, with a turquoise and gold ornament fastened in the center, and a long pigtail down the back. The ornament is a small charm box worn by officials of high rank. The Kalon Lama spoke for the Kashag, Rimshi Kayapup translated. The two lay ministers showed great respect for his seniority. They scarcely opened their mouths and contented themselves with nodding at the High Lama's statements. After the customary polite questions regarding Pertrip, the Kalon Lama asked the question which seems to be on everybody's lips in Tibet: has communism come to stay in China and will it keep spreading across Asia? No one can answer that difficult question, replied my father. But in my opinion, communism may not have a lasting effect on China's age-old culture and civilization. Chinese life up to now has always centered on the family and on religion, and both are institutions which Red Doctrine opposes. Even if communism is not entirely cast off, China may modify it to such an extent that negation it is no longer a part of a Moscow-directed scheme for world conquest. We hope what you say will happen and soon enough to help save Tibet, the Kalon Lama pronounced gravely, speaking for his colleagues, who nodded sagely in agreement. When the Shapatilda copyright S took their leave, the two foreign ministers, Sakang Dzaza, the lay member of the team, and the monk Luishao Dzaza Lama, urged us to join them over cups of buttered tea. They proceeded to tell us about Tibet's two main problems, communism and China. These problems were the main reason the Dalai Lama and his government had given us permission to visit Lhasa. By the lucky timing of our request, we had been chosen to tell our countrymen about Tibet's international problems and to ask Washington what military aid the United States might be able to give Tibet. In an earlier chapter, one related most of our interview with the foreign ministers. They told us that Tibet had been completely independent since 1912, in spite of China's insistence that it was a Chinese province, and they explained why Red China is now bent on the military conquest of Tibet. At the conclusion of their detailed account of Chinese-Tibetan relations, which was translated for us piecemeal by interpreter Kayapup, the ministers, without any fancy camouflage, came to the point directly: if the communists strike Tibet, will America help? And to what extent? Tough questions to answer. We were in Tibet as private citizens, not as official representatives of the United States. Naturally, we had no authority to offer them any encouragement. All we could venture was our belief that our country would be sympathetic, but that actual material aid would depend chiefly on United States public opinion as reflected in the action of Congress. They did not derive much satisfaction from that reply. It is difficult for Tibetans to understand the working of the democratic system, so contrary to their own feudal form of government. Actually, we were asked the same questions over and over again in Lhasa. Monks as well as laymen were deeply concerned about the future of their nation. The foreign ministers had no idea what type of military assistance they need. I doubt that even the Tibetan army generals could put down their requirements specifically on paper. How could they, out of touch as they are with military developments beyond their borders. The Chinese communists, if they invade, probably will do so by way of the northern plateau and desert, from the Kumbum and Lake Kokono region. By that route it is about 600 miles to Lhasa. The first 200 miles would be simple, but from then on it might not be too difficult for skillful guerrilla forces to harass an invader, cut his supply lines and make his venture too costly. The most important requirement, of course, is skillful guerrilla forces. To create these, Tibet needs arms and advice principally from outside. Arms would include weapons especially adapted to guerrilla warfare, such as Garand rifles, machine guns, mortars, grenades and mines. The kind of advice needed is technical instruction in the proper use and maintenance of this modern equipment, and in the most advanced methods of guerrilla strategy. I believe that there is sufficient manpower in Tibet for defense purposes, if it is properly equipped and trained. Indeed, we got the impression in Lhasa that allied troops, beyond a small group of military advisors, would not be welcome. If the Chinese attack, they will have to march into Tibet on foot. Trucks and tanks would be of little use in a country of ice-bound mountains, with no roads, and an average elevation between 14 and 18,000 feet. The Reds may attempt to parachute troops into Tibet. This is a possibility, if Russia supplies the air power. The Chinese could wait for a day when the weather is perfect to fly in an army. The execution of such an operation would take only one day. The best Tibetan answer to airborne Red troops would be a formidable ground army. It has been said that the roof of the world would make an ideal airfield. As a World War II Air Force pilot, I can imagine no worse region in which to base aviation, to make daily flights in and out of an area where the weather is generally bad and where the clouds have solid cores up to 30,000 feet would be suicidal. Present-day aircraft would also have great difficulty operating from airfields, most of which would have to be 14,000 feet and more above sea level. Besides, the problem of supplying Tibetan airfields with fuel, parts and other equipment would take on incredible proportions. In my opinion, the Dalai Lama's kingdom is decidedly not a natural airdrome. I am being asked repeatedly why our country does not lend Tibet a hand. My father and I have discussed the Tibetan problem with our government heads. This seems to be the answer. If the United States offers any kind of military assistance to Tibet, our country must assume the responsibility of maintaining Tibetan independence. But if the Chinese Reds called our bluff, how could we move an army over the Himalayas? How could we supply it? In the final analysis, the United States is not the nation to undertake that task. Furthermore, our government thinks that the Chinese are not likely to attempt an armed invasion of Tibet as long as the Western powers make no move to draw Tibet into their camp. The latest news from our friends in Lhasa in the fall of 1950 was that Tibet could take a breather at least until the spring of 1951 and that there would be no invasion until warm weather set in again. By that time, the Tibetan peace delegation, now in New Delhi and led by our friend Tsepan Shekhabpa, might come to terms with Red China. As I write, talks are beginning between Shekhabpa and the Chinese Communist ambassador to India. As one Indian official remarked, both Chinese and Tibetans are experts at delaying things. The Tibetan-Chinese negotiations may drag along for many months, but there are indications that in any settlement Tibet will be permitted self-rule under nominal Chinese suzerainty. The next official on our calling list that day was Zarong Shape, a former general of the Tibetan army. Now retired, and 63, Zarong is a famous person in his homeland and the wealthiest man in Tibet. The son of a maker of arrows, he started out a poor boy in Lhasa and wound up as the Rockefeller of Limaland. This really is an achievement in a feudal society that offers few opportunities outside the priesthood to a young man of low station. Zarong, originally Tsimshian Namgyel, was given his present name and title by the 13th Dalai Lama. The boy worked first for the official in charge of the grounds of Norbulinga, the Dalai Lama's summer palace. Later, in the service of the court physician, he came to the attention of the Dalai Lama, who liked the boy's looks and took him on as an assistant valet. He became a great favorite with the priest king and accompanied him in exile to Mongolia, when the British invaded Tibet in 1904, and to India, during the Chinese raids in 1910. During the flight to India, Sensen, in charge of a group of the Dalai Lama's troops, bravely held an overwhelming number of Chinese soldiers at bay until the ruler escaped. On his return to the capital in 1912, the Dalai Lama found that the head of the Zarongs, the richest and one of the oldest noble families in Tibet, had been collaborating with the Chinese. Whereupon the ruler had the men of that family flung bodily from the roof of the Potala. Then he gave the women of the family, their estates and the Zarong name to Tsensen, the young man who had saved his life and served him so faithfully during exile. He also made him a Shapay Tilda copyright, a member of the powerful Kashag, and commander-in-chief of the Tibetan army. Heavy set, short, with a deeply lined face and thinning hair, Zarong Shapay Tilda copyright is the favorite of nearly all who visit Lhasa, for he is a Tibetan patriarch of broad vision, great charm and a delightful sense of humor. Zarong's house on the outskirts of the city combines Tibetan and Western architecture. It was the finest private mansion we visited in Lhasa. Instead of being built around the typical Tibetan courtyard, it is surrounded by an attractive garden, beautifully landscaped with many shrubs, trees and flowers. And all the windows are of glass. Some of the rooms are furnished in Western style, others according to the best Tibetan tradition. In his spacious, hospitable home, Zarong and his family entertain lavishly, regally and frequently. His son, called George by his schoolmates when he went outside to a Darjeeling school, is now carrying on the unusual family tradition of improving conditions among the people on the plateau. Zarong does not speak English, but George acted as our interpreter. Zarong was especially interested in hearing our views on Russia. "Is it true that the Russians have no religion?" Zarong asked in the course of our conversation. "The Communist Party from the Politburo down to the young pioneers has only one religion," Dad replied, "the religion of communism world revolution. That is, if you can call that a religion. But how about the Russian people?" Zarong continued. "Are they told the truth about world events and conditions outside of Russia?" Dad's answer, "Well, you know it in advance," was an emphatic no. Zarong has always advocated the opening of his isolated country to Western ideas and modern improvements that would prove beneficial. The more fanatical lamas, especially those in the three big monasteries near Lhasa, opposing any changes or innovation, are bitterly hostile to him. But Zarong is courageous. Did he not risk his own life to save his master, the 13th Dalai Lama? And he is tough-minded, too, under his jolly manner. Zarong would like to see Tibet accorded diplomatic recognition by the West, admitted to the United Nations, and given assistance to develop an army strong enough to defend its borders. To Zarong Shapay Tilda copyright, the cause of the world's problems is greed. The ultimate solution, he thinks, is world government, but the time is not yet ripe for it because of the self-interest displayed by all nations. However, he is not resigned to the inevitability of a third world war. For, he told us, the rival powers may realize at the last moment that global cooperation is the only means to survival. A truly magnificent view of the Potala, the palace of the gods, snapped from the top of nearby Iron Hill. The city of Lhasa proper is out of the limits of this photograph, extending beyond the right side. 15. The Potala, Tibet's Vatican. If all roads in Italy lead to Rome and the Vatican, CD, all trails in Tibet converge on Lhasa and the Potala, the winter palace of the Dalai Lama. Before we reached Lhasa, we caught a glimpse of its gold roofs from afar, and realized what the first sight of this building, one of the most striking and unique in the world, must symbolize to the weary and devout pilgrim who has made the long trek over the mountain passes to his holy city. Even foreign visitors of different faith, like us, are thrilled by this soaring mass of red and white masonry a mile or so out of Lhasa, dominating the city from Red Hill, one of the many rocky hills that rise unexpectedly, isolated from the high Tibetan plains. From the time of the early missionaries, every Westerner fortunate enough to reach Lhasa has added his bit to swell the glowing descriptions of the Potla. No steel or iron was used in its construction, yet it is such a perfect structure that Spencer Chapman, member of a British mission to Lhasa in 1936, wrote, "The Potala gives the impression not of having been built by man but of having grown there, so perfectly does it fit in with its surroundings." One heartily agrees with him that it is a supremely great work of architecture, having an indefinable quality of magic. And as he says, in common with the few unquestionably perfect buildings of the world, the Potala has some transcendent quality derived neither from the inspired skill of some master builder or craftsman, nor from its historical association, nor from the fact that it is the cynosure of innumerable religious devotees. Anyone seeing the palace of the gods would be aware of what Chapman calls its divine excellence. Every day in Lhasa we were conscious of the Potala. When we got up in the morning we looked out of our windows at its gold roofs, dazzling in the sun. When we rode home in the evening after enjoying the exuberant hospitality of a Tibetan official living on the edge of town, its vast white and red facade took on the appearance of an enchanted castle in a child's fairy tale, or perhaps because of its massiveness and a certain grimness, it seemed more like a sky castle of the Valkyries in Wagner's operatic Ring. Wherever we went we saw some angle of the Potala, each more fascinating than the last. Crowded as we were with interviews and parties and getting the reaction of leading officials to their pressing and critical problems, we were determined to devote as much of one busy day as we could to the winter home of the Dalai Lama. So we set off one forenoon to take photographs and make a tour of this fabulous building, the most famous in Central Asia. Seen from a little distance or from the top of Iron Hill, where the College of Medicine stands, the Potala, in a vast circle of snow-peaked mountains and surrounded by a closer circle of green trees and parks, has an even more impressive setting than India's Taj Mahal, but unlike the Taj it is no exquisitely carved and filigreed marble gem. What really leaves one a bit breathless is its tremendous size, the grandeur of its simple, almost austere facade, and there, way the foundations seem to rise naturally out of the rock. It is hard to tell where the hill ends and the building begins. The Potala is 900 feet long and a little more than that in height, from the street level to 2/3 the height of New York's Empire State Building. Indeed, it reminded us of an American skyscraper, towering as it does over the whole Lhasa scene. The walls slope slightly inward, and long rows of windows, wider at the bottom than at the top, accentuate the symmetry and general effect. On the southern side, standing out above the immense white wall, is the central portion, colored a deep crimson, signifying special sanctity because of the chapels located in this section. In September the yak hair curtains which offer protection from the glare of the sun are removed from the windows, and every September, too, the white walls are given a fresh coat of paint. We did not witness this annual house cleaning. The whitewash, mixed near the Potala, is carried in buckets on the backs of women and dashed up against the wall from dippers. The section of wall that cannot be reached from below is splashed with whitewash thrown out of the upper windows. The celebrated Tibetan king Songtsen Gampo, the one who was converted to Buddhism by his two Buddhist queens, built himself a combined fort and palace on Red Hill in the 7th century, but most of this was destroyed in later years by an invading Mongol army. On this site the revered 5th Dalai Lama began the construction of the Potala in 1641. It must have been as difficult to build as the pyramids of Egypt. For this architectural triumph was made with primitive tools, the same tools that are used in Tibet today. Each stone had to be carried from a distant quarry by donkeys or on the backs of men and women, one stone per person lashed to the back with yak thongs. Most of the actual supervision of the work was delegated by the Dalai Lama to his efficient chief minister, Sangai Gyatso. The great fifth died in 1680 before the building was completed. Sangai Gyatso concealed for 249 the Potala Tibetes Vatican 9 years the departure of the fifth to the heavenly field. He gave out word that His Holiness had gone into retirement to meditate, an explanation both acceptable and plausible to Tibetans. This enabled the clever minister to complete the putla. The faithful were willing to do all this heavy labor and without payment for and in the name of their living God, whom they still believed to be with them in the flesh, but not for the minister, important as he was. The residence for the reincarnations of Chenrezig was almost 50 years in the building, not so long when one recalls that the Gothic cathedrals of Europe were painstakingly built over a much longer period, and that New York's Cathedral of St. John the Divine, started in 1892, is only 2/3 completed now, in spite of the advantages of rapid construction in our modern machine age. The new palace got its name from a hill on Cape Comorin at the southern tip of India, a rocky point sacred to the God of Mercy, whom the Indians call Avalokitesvara and the Tibetans worship as Chenrezig. The Tibetans themselves rarely speak of the sacred palace as the Potala, but rather as Peak Potala, Sipotala, or usually as the Peak. The fifth Dalai Lama did live for a time in the completed part of the Potala before he died. And the regent, his chief minister, also lived there while he was bringing the stupendous undertaking to its conclusion. Next to occupy the sacred headquarters was the sixth Dalai Lama, the first and only one in the whole line who strayed from the path of celibacy and virtue. This was a natural consequence of the regent's concealment of the great fifth's death. Usually the Dalai Lamas are removed from their parents at a very tender age and impressed by their Lama tutors with the significance of their divine origin and the importance of their duties to the people. But Tsangyang Jiatso, his name means melodious purity, must have been between 10 and 12 when he was discovered. His character and inclinations were formed before the High Lamas could take him in. 251 of the many treasures of the Potala is this fabulous image of the great fifth Dalai Lama, who made Lhasa the capital and began building the Potala. The image is of solid gold. Before it is an offering of butter. 251. The Potala, Tibet's Vatican hand. He made it his concern to beautify the new palace, and he planned and constructed the serpent house below the north ramparts. Here he indulged in life's most worldly pleasures, wine, women, and the entertainment of dancing girls. Nor should one omit song. He composed poetry himself, mostly love songs, which are still popular in Lhasa. Obviously he should have followed the career of a charming young man about town, and not that of the incarnate God of Mercy. Here in the English version by Sir Charles Bell are a few lines from one of his poems, showing the torment his soul endured in a godlike post for which his whole temperament unfitted him. Dear love, to whom my heart goes out, if we could but be wed, then had I gained the choicest gem from ocean's deepest bed. I chanced to pass my sweetheart fair upon the road one day, a turquoise found of clearest blue found to be thrown away. My heart's far off, the nights pass by in sleeplessness and strife, e'en day brings not my heart's distir, for lifeless is my life. I dwell apart in Potala, a god on earth am I, but in the town the chief of rogues and boisterous revelry. Needless to say, devout Mongols and others doubted that melodious purity was the true incarnation of the great fifth. 252 The Potala, Tibet's Vatican. He was finally seized and carried off by Mongolian troops, and was either murdered or died as a result of the rough treatment he received. It is interesting to note that the Tibetans themselves took no part in doing away with melodious purity. The monks at Drepung did their best to rescue him from the Mongols, who stormed the monastery where he was in hiding. Even today Tibetans persist in their loyalty to him and excuse his disorderly conduct on the ground that he had two bodies. One remained in meditation in the Potala and the other wandered into the streets and dissolute byways of Lhasa to test the faith of his followers. Everyone who lives in Lhasa and all pilgrims to the Forbidden City make the sacred walk around the Potala at least once a year. It is a hike of several miles, always done in the clockwise direction, with the Potala kept auspiciously at one's right. As we puffed up the huge steps of the giant, zigzagging stairway, we passed a number of Tibetans making the circuit. They were whirling their prayer wheels as they kept reciting, Om Mani Padme Hum. The Potala contains more than 1,000 rooms. On the lower floors are storerooms, government offices, kitchens and living quarters for 200 or 300 monks, many of them young celibates in training, selected from the sons of the nobility and official classes. Some go into government service and some remain in the Potala, where the Dalai Lama has his own private monastery, called the College of Victorious Heaven. Two of the four Tibetan treasuries are housed in the Potala. One retreat is reserved for the Dalai Lama's private use. Another, the Treasury of the Sons of Heaven, is a reserve treasury to meet the expenses of war or other national emergencies. Everything from butter and tea to gold, silver and precious gems is stored in the fortress-like lower depths of the Potala. The accumulated contents of these treasuries over the past 2.5 centuries must be invaluable. It is said that yak butter in the Tibetan climate will keep 100 years, but I for one would not care to experiment. To add a note of grimness, prisoners are kept, sometimes for life, in the dungeons below. Toward the summit are numerous chapels, great audience halls and meeting rooms, as well as the spacious apartments of the Dalai Lama and his close advisors and attendants. But we did not have time to see everything, nor would we have been permitted to do so, any more than a visitor to the White House can barge into all the private rooms and offices. We concentrated on the tombs of the Dalai Lamas and the summit. As we climbed higher, we heard hundreds of monks chanting inside the vast building. There was the roll of drums, the clash of cymbals, the whir of prayer wheels and the throb of deep bass horns. Along the west side of the Potala are the tombs of several of the Dalai Lamas. The sixth is conspicuously absent. The shrines are built somewhat after the pattern of courtens and covered on top with heavy gold leaf. It is the pure gold domes of these tombs that glisten so radiantly in the sun, and they are the first glimpse distant travelers get of the Potala. We entered the sanctified chambers where the bodies of the Dalai Lamas are entombed in their toe and three gold-capped pyramids. Hundreds of yak butter lamps in gold vessels flickered in front of the crypts as the monks were conducting their services. The tomb of the Great Fifth, 60 feet high, and that of the Great 13th, even higher, are the most resplendent. From all over the Lamaist Buddhist world the pious contributed generously to the building of the late Dalai Lama's shrine. The main courtyard is encased with gold and richly encrusted in rare jewels, and the interior is filled with priceless old Chinese porcelain, jewelry, gold vases, and many other rare art treasures of Asia. Around the upper walls of the tomb a dozen of the finest artists in Tibet worked for several years on a series of frescoes. Exquisitely painted, they commemorate events in the strenuous life of the 13th Dalai Lama, his exile to Mongolia and China, his flight and exile to India, the trains, automobiles and other strange objects he encountered in the outside world, processions of monks, Lhasa scenes and festivals, as well as the Potala and other features of his life at home. Interesting, too, is an enameled piece at the tomb of the 8th Dalai Lama, who died in 1804, showing English people and houses of that period, undoubtedly one of those done in China for the old East India Company. The Dalai Lamas during their own lifetime collected much of the gold, precious stones and currency required for their splendid tombs. After we paid our respect to the tombs we climbed to the top of the Potala, among the golden roofs. The city of Lhasa lay at our feet to the east. Directly across the way on Iron Hill rose the Tibetan Medical College, which I mentioned in another chapter. To the north and west, nestled at the foot of the mountains, were the great monasteries of Sera and Drepung, which we were to visit before we left. Many smaller monasteries, too, clung to the steep edges of distant cliffs. To the south we saw the Kyachu winding its way along the plain, making this district one of the most fertile in Tibet. Directly below us was a deep blue lake, with a small gold-endowed monastery on an island in the center. It was an enchanting, almost unbelievable panorama. Only the whir of our movie cameras, photographing this breathtaking scene, reminded us that we were still creatures of Earth, not of some mythical planet. Below the Vale, on which we were standing, we looked down on the winding road which is for the exclusive use of the Dalai Lama. He is carried up that path in a palanquin whenever he returns to his winter residence. Tibet not only permits no wheeled vehicles, but even the ancient palanquin carried by bearers is forbidden to all but the God King, the Panchen Lama and the Thunderbolt. So, while we were on the roof, we learned from one of our Tibetan companions that hail must not fall on the Potala or the Dalai Lama's summer palace or on the Jokhang, the cathedral.